Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for the 16th of August, 2019. It is a Friday. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the program. Action-packed as it is. It's the Friday interview edition, which means you don't have to listen to me rant for very long before we get to hear from somebody else. This week, it's Ben Howe on his new book, The Immoral Majority. We had a long conversation, an interesting conversation. It was, I found it entertaining, and I don't often find them entertaining. And I learned some things, and I think you will too. And you can enter to win a signed copy of his book at the end of the program. We also draw for the signed Liz Wheeler books, so you've got that going for you. It was good. And I know a lot of people don't like Ben. They're mad at Ben. But I think Ben makes a pretty good case for his case. And I challenged him. I didn't get up in his grill. I didn't go at him like a rabid spider monkey, just because anybody who's nice enough to come in, I'm going to treat him with respect, except for someone like Rachel Maddow, who doesn't deserve it. People who lie to people all the time don't deserve it. But people who have honest disagreements, even if I think they're wrong, and I don't think Ben's wrong about everything. It's explained throughout the interview, but you know, nice enough. I almost had Andrew Yang on the show. I would still love to get Andrew Yang on the show if he's ever in D.C. I find the guy very interesting. I don't know that I could ever support him, but I find him to be honest, unlike so many other people who are running for president. All those Democrats are just telling you what they want to hear, what their pollsters say. Andrew Yang, I think, I hope he doesn't get co-opted by the consultant class, but I think he's out there telling you what he really believes. A Kamala Harris, I don't see much. And an Elizabeth Warren could be interesting. Bernie Sanders is another person I think is probably telling you what they really think. They're just crazy. But Andrew Yang, I like the fact that he's been very specific about what he wants to do. Some Beto O'Rourke is, you might as well talk to a rock. Anyway, before we get to the interview, which if you don't like, it's only one show, and you know, you can email me and complain about it. If you do like it, email me and let me know. And you can win a signed copy of his book. Even if you disagree with the guy, you can learn something from somebody. So I was already getting pre-hate mail. What are you having him on for? Well, A, because I like him as a person. And B, he's got a book out. It's an interesting topic, whether you agree with it or not, or 100%, 80%, whatever. It's interesting. But first, a little housekeeping, of course. We've got to thank our great sponsor, Life Change Tea. Oh, Life Change Tea. It is a game changer. It really is. Changes everything. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I've noticed that I feel cleaner, if you will. I have more energy, more pep in my step. And it's not just because it's Friday and I'm ready for the weekend. No, that band was ready for the world, not ready for the weekend. How does it work? Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula. It's a gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of harmful intruders, and it's tasty, too. Let's face it, food was different 60 years ago. It wasn't as processed and full of pesticides, nourishing and healthy for your body the way it was then, back when it was more natural. Today, not so much. GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, heavy processing. They've depleted the nutrition from our food. It's no wonder you feel run down. Well, plus you got coatings. You got stuff inside you that you need to get out. And this Life Change Tea does that. Use as directed. I use it as directed, and you want to use it as directed. I've heard stories of people who drank like a bunch of it all at once. You don't want to do that. It's very specific purpose, and it works. So take your time, follow the instructions, and get that stuff out of you. All you got to do is go to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. Life Change Tea isn't available in stores. You go to getthetea.com, and you enter the promo code Derek at checkout, and you get free shipping. If you don't get free shipping, email me. Because I've been sending some people, there's a problem. I don't understand the technical aspects of it, but we get it straightened out. So email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. The promo code Derek will get you free shipping. Give it a shot. What have you got to lose? Well, you'd be surprised what you've got to lose. Oh, yes, and one more thing. If you have questions or if you have whatever, since we can't do calls, maybe someday, I'm kind of looking into maybe getting people on Skype and trying to do that. Email me questions. I want to do a show next week, I think, where I just respond to emails and tell the stories that you guys, I guess I've alluded to a lot of stories and haven't followed up on them. So if you want to, if you have something, or even if it's just news related, what do you think of this, or how? What's an update on that, or whatever, email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com, include it, and you might hear your email read and your name read on the program next week. Alrighty, so before we get to the interview, there is some news of the day. I don't know if you can hear my daughter Quinn over on the other couch. She's watching what she calls Elmo Cookie. She's obsessed with something called PJ Mask and eating cashews well past her bedtime. But she wouldn't go down, so here she is. The big story, the big scandal, the big thing that's got all liberals in a bunch, oh my goodness, is that two of the Gang of Four members were denied entry to Israel. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are traveling on our dime, you're welcome, you ingrates, around the world, and they wanted to go to Israel as part of that trip, mostly to meet, well, not mostly, exclusively to meet with Palestinian activists with terrorist ties. It's kind of like, oh yeah, you know, come on in and go ahead and go right to the Palestinian territories and meet with whoever you want. They didn't bother to try and meet with any Israeli government officials. Nothing. They had no interest in that because they hate Israel. They hate Jews. They are part of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Sanction, and Divest. The BDS movement is anti-Semitic. They seek to end Israel. They want to destroy Israel's economy. They want to destroy Israel and make it Palestine, which doesn't exist. The problem, in addition to these two anti-Semites, you know, this is what's messed up. Israel decided not to let these people into their country, which is their right to do. It's kind of weird that it's even a debate. Every country has the right to decide who comes into their country. You can dislike the decision, but you can't say they don't have a right to do it. These two congresswomen and the rest of the Gang of Four and the rest of the Democrats are all for open borders. Anybody, come on. Everybody should be able to come in here. That leads to disaster. So it's nice that every once in a while they get a stark reminder that countries control who enters them, or should. That it's an important part of being a country. Now, it's embarrassing to this country that these two members of Congress are members of Congress, that we would have open, rabid anti-Semites elected as Democrats or any party in the United States Congress, but, you know, that's who the Democrats choose. That's where the Democratic Party is moving. But Israel, I love it. I heard this report earlier, thanks to an obscure law in Israel. There's no obscure law. It was passed a few years ago that said that Israel reserves the right to refuse entry to anyone who is in support of the BDS movement. Boycott, sanction, and divest. They want to harm Israel. They want to harm the economy of Israel. So they said, no, no thanks, you're not welcome. Because, well, there are many reasons, one of which is the fact that they did not set up or make any effort whatsoever to meet with Israeli government officials, which you would think if you're over there on an official congressional visit, you might want to have a chat with somebody from the government you're about to go into the country of. They wanted to meet with a bunch of people, a bunch of Palestinians, who many of them have, one organization is very chummy with terrorist organizations. So they said no. What they also did, another reason that Israel said no, is on their official itinerary from their offices right at the top, it says that they're a congressional delegation to Palestine. And of course, Palestine does not exist. Palestine is what they would like to exist after they destroy Israel, after Hamas destroys Israel. So right there on official congressional letterhead with the full sanction of the United States Congress, the Democratic Party, these members of Congress, they ignore, they wipe out, they eliminate the existence of Israel. So they go to a country, they don't want to meet with the government, anybody in government, and their official itinerary is the name of the country enemies of Israel want to wipe it off the map to replace it with. So hell no, you wouldn't let these piles of human garbage, these dumpster fires, into your country, give a political victory to your opponents, your opponent who randomly launches rockets into it. You know, that's who they are. So, of course, the left is beside themselves. The media can't believe it. Why would Israel do this? This is just wrong. Rashida Tlaib tweeted a photograph of her grandmother. She tweeted, "This woman right here is my city." S-I-T-Y. Probably add an S in there, or an H in there. "She deserves to live in peace and with human dignity. I am who I am because of her. The decision by Israel to bar her granddaughter, a U.S. congresswoman, is a sign of weakness because the truth of what is happening to Palestinians is frightening." I agree with her there. The truth of what's happening to Palestinians is frightening. They are being manipulated by their leaders into hating Israel. Many of them, particularly children, are being used as human shields. Bombs are being strapped to special needs kids, and they're sent into crowds and remotely detonated. Yes, what is happening to Palestinians is incredibly frightening. Rashida, perhaps you should find a reflective surface and, well, reflect. Crazy idea, I know, but you ain't the victim. In many ways, you're the perp. And so being completely, completely anti-Semitic doesn't pay off for these Democrats. It's nice to finally get some pushback. Sadly, they will return to this country. You know, that's just how it is. Ilhan Omar tweeted out, of course, she's dumb on top of everything else. "It is in the front that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, under pressure from President Trump, would deny entry to representatives of the U.S. government." Nah, it's an affront to human decency that you would think you could go over there for a photo op and to aid and abet people who want to destroy a country and think that that country would allow you in. Borders matter. I know you don't like that. I know you don't want that. But they do. And hopefully, and I pray to God, that this country wises the hell up and recognizes that in the next election before it's too late. Because it's almost too late. It really is. The Democrats get control. Forget it. The country's gone. All right. In other news, there is new polling data out that's showing that right now, Elizabeth Warren is making a surge. She's making a jump. She's running past the rest of the field, catching up to Joe Biden, depending on the state, surpassing Joe Biden. One poll in Iowa has Elizabeth Warren at 28% and Joe Biden tied with Bernie Sanders at 17%. That is a seismic shift in just a month. Now, this is just Iowa. Iowa isn't indicative of much of anything, but it's part of a pattern of people looking at Joe Biden beyond the name recognition. Because remember, up until people really, really started heavily campaigning, it was, oh, I know Joe Biden. Joe Biden was Barack Obama's vice president. Well, for most of 8 years, vice presidents tend to go into the witness protection program. They're only needed in case of emergencies. Nobody cares about what the vice president says. So Joe Biden, his gaffes flew under the radar. He was propped up because the media, he was propped up accidentally. It's like jacking up a car because Barack Obama's in the driver's seat. Well, you got Joe Biden in the passenger seat, more likely in a kiddie seat in the back playing with some rubber peanuts or something. And he gets propped up because of it by proxy. Well, Barack Obama left the car. Nobody's going to jack up. This is a horrible analogy. It sounds sexual, but I don't mean it to. I'm just thinking, nobody's going to jack up Joe Biden's car. So he's got to take care of it himself. And one thing that has been noticed by the press is that Joe Biden hasn't really had very many public campaign events, something like one in the last 10 days. He's staying off the campaign trail, and many of his campaign advisors are privately, and this is why everybody in politics is garbage. If you're really paid to advise a campaign, keep it to yourself, the advice that you give them. But somebody is telling the press that Joe Biden, his campaign staff, thinks that it might be better to have fewer events. Try and ride his name recognition to the nomination, because the more people see of him, well, you see the polls. People have watched two debates, they've seen campaign speeches, and they've seen gaffe after gaffe after gaffe. If you constantly step on rakes when you leave the house, one way to at least lower the number of times you step on a rake is to stop leaving the house. If every time you open your mouth in public, you make a humiliating, stupid, dumb gaffe, well, rather than try and improve as a candidate, which I think even Joe Biden admits isn't really an option, the only other way to address that is do fewer campaign events. Keep it private. Keep it down. Now, they're going to be doing fundraisers, of course, because that's the lifeblood of politics. He'll be hanging out with really rich people, hammering their checks and giving talks to them. And if history is any guide, somebody will donate whatever the minimum amount is to attend that and record it on their phone. So if he's still making gaffes, it will come out. I don't understand anybody who's like, here's $1,000 so I can come in and try to publicly humiliate somebody. Remember, it was Mitt Romney's 47% thing about, you know, 47% of the country who just likes to get free stuff from government, whatever the whole quote was. That was recorded secretly, surreptitiously at a fundraiser by somebody who paid to be at the fundraiser. So it happens all the time. Barack Obama's, they're clinging to their gods and their guns and their Bible. That was surreptitiously recorded at a fundraiser. Who are these people with money to just go, you know what? I want to get $500 worth of clicks on the internet because I'll record something privately, and I'll pay $2,500 for that. Send me the $2,500 and I'll doctor you up a recording and we'll call it even. How's that? But, it's kind of interesting that Joe Biden is starting to slip. Elizabeth Warren is the flavor of the month. This is the thing about politics. You want to peak, but you never want to peak too soon. Peaking 6 months, 5-6 months before there are any votes might be a little too soon, especially when you're just not really personable. Like Elizabeth Warren isn't really personable. But then when you look down the rest of the field, you're like, there's nobody. Joe Biden, sad to say, is the most affable person running as a Democrat. You'd think there'd be somebody out there, but none of them are. You wouldn't want to. It's the beer test. You wouldn't want to have a beer with any of them. But if you had to choke down a natty beau with one of them, it'd probably be Joe Biden. Or I'd like to, again, have a drink with Andrew Yang, but good God, could you imagine? Cory Booker would demand a Zima and drink it with his pinky out. Amy Klobuchar, she'd just yell at the waitstaff. Beto O'Rourke would chug it and leave. He'd be gone. He'd be right behind the wheel of a car, just like, you got another one of these? Another eight of these for the road? And he'd be gone. Tom Steyer probably doesn't drink beer. And Bernie Sanders would want half of your beer. So it would just be a complete waste of time. So that's the latest in the Democratic world. I'll have a lot more to say about that next week as more is fleshed out and we get more polls. But the trend line is not looking good for Sniffy Uncle Joe. Currently looking good for Elizabeth Warren. But you got to remember, Bernie Sanders was up there and he's faded. Pete Buttigieg was the next hero and He's faded. Kamala Harris, after the debate, oh, the first debate, she's sorry, she's going to be huge. It's going to, and she never really got any, she actually lost ground since then. Spartacus didn't show up. Beto O'Rourke has relaunched his campaign, and still nobody cares. So the field over there is a disaster. It's a mess. It is trying to find. It's like digging in through a box of rusty razor blades for your car keys. You need your car keys. You got to have your keys or you're going to be stuck there all day. You got to have some kind of key. But you got to go through all these rusty razors to get to it. Lockjaw just ain't worth it. Anyway, there's other stuff, but it's Friday. You want to get on with your weekend, and we've got a good interview. I thought it was at parts. It was funny. I was funny, at least. Ben's funny guy. Honest. It was probing and tough. He had some tough questions come at his way. And, well, here it is. Don't forget, though, by the way, just as a reminder, they're not sponsoring this episode anymore, but if you're going to order some takeout, some delivery this weekend and use DoorDash, download the app to your smartphone or tablet. Use the promo code CALLER. You get $5 off your first order of $15 or more. It really is well worth it. Anyway, thank you again for listening. Thanks for telling a friend and rating and reviewing. The numbers keep going up. It's all because of you. And have a great weekend. Now, here is the interview with Ben Howe. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller Podcast, the Friday video edition. It is August 16th, 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your Mr. Rourke for the show. Welcome to it. Thank you for tuning in, telling a friend, spreading the word, sharing on social media, and all those good things. As we do every Friday, we bring somebody into our life. We can pick their brain, talk about their books, learn something from them, or whatever. They're usually better than us. This week is an exception. We're joined in studio by Ben Howe. He's the author of the new book, The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Sinner.
I want to talk about a broad array of things, including the book, because on some things I agree with you, some things I don't. And just like on Twitter, some things I agree with you, some things I don't. But first, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, yeah, as you know, I along with a lot of other people, objected to Donald Trump's candidacy very early on.
Right.
I think a lot of people, even who support him today.
I was an early adapter. Yeah. I was a Marco Rubio fan, and then I was with Ted Cruz, mostly because I thought Donald Trump would lose. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think he believed in anything.
Mm-hmm. I would say I didn't have the moral objections that I'm talking to in this book, or that I'm speaking to in this book, it was sort of the same mentality for me. I was not only thought he would lose, my concern was I didn't think he would be good long term for conservatism, mm-hmm. and whatever isn't good for conservatism in my mind was bad for the future electoral prospects of the Republican Party, and that was my biggest concern. And I called myself a Ted Cruzio supporter. Either one of them would have been fine.
I thought Hillary was eminently beatable, and I came around to Trump. I reluctantly voted for him. Mm-hmm. The way he's governed, I've been pleasantly surprised by, for the most part. Not mm-hmm. necessarily the way he's always conducted himself,
sure,
but the way he's done. And I've been able to disconnect the tweets from the policies.
Sure.
And there seem to be a lot of people who can't.
Yes. And I would say that in 2016, my primary objections were literally about him. Like, it was that guy, what he's saying, and what I don't like. Which makes sense. It was a year where you're voting on somebody.
And there were 17 choices. So right. You could have, and all obviously the way up somebody to, you agree with more.
All the way up to Election Day, what I started to focus on a little more was the manner in which I saw some people supporting him. There was this call at the time, even among you know, the Schlichters of this world, mm-hmm. or the Derricks of this world, you know, of let's call balls and strikes, hold them accountable, you know, and hope for the best. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a reasonable way to look at it, but I also felt like there were a lot of people that weren't looking at it that way. They were using the typical almost Obama-like support where you're, everything this guy does is good.
Right.
Everything he says is great. Every misstep isn't a misstep. Well, usually, it's actually a calculated, brilliant, strategic move. And I started to focus more on why are you guys not calling, not you guys, but why are people not calling these balls and strikes like they said they would? And it was among Christians that it bothered me the most.
Among Christians, you were an evangelical.
I am an evangelical.
You are an evangelical.
Mm-hmm. Remember, 81% supported him. That means 19% did not.
Right. But I'm just trying to frame you. Your father is a very noted evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
David Limbaugh once told me that he was very instrumental in helping him figure out his way in through the Bible.
Absolutely.
When you are going after something critically, from a perspective of love, it's not you guys are scum. It's mm-hmm. it's more the disappointment of a parent whose child ends up in trouble.
Yeah.
How does your father respond to that?
He was instrumental in how I approached this whole topic because we're very aligned on all of it. Mm. And he and my mother had always shown me a form of Christianity that is displayed in a way that I think is a great way to be. They're reasoned, logical, and informed, but compassionate, empathetic, loving, and all of those things. That was what I grew up around, and I just didn't feel like that was the current incarnation of the evangelical movement. I didn't think it was as obvious to me in previous elections, because one of the interesting things about Donald Trump is that he pushes that any cognitive dissonance that it would take. A George W. Bush, he acts like one of them. You know what I mean? He talks like one. He's a born-again Christian. Right. So it was easier to talk like one as well in support of him, because there was nothing that put pressure on that idea. Trump put pressure on that idea.
In what way are you talking about the pressure? Are you talking about the three marriages? Are you talking about the tone of him smacking back? You'll agree, Donald Trump doesn't see somebody and walk up and smack them in the back of the head, minding their own business. He hits back.
He does hit back, but I think that he definitely hits forward quite as... I mean,
he'll hit out of the blue at people who've hit at him in the past. It's not like somebody's just minding their own business and he picks a name out of the phone book and goes, this guy's a jerk.
It's definitely not, you know, I don't even think I mentioned the divorces unless I was quoting somebody who mentioned them.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not the idea, or the idea that I have is not that somebody has a certain life that they have changed in, or is it me saying we need a pastor or... you know, we shouldn't vote for them. I don't think that either. But I did feel like a lot of what Donald Trump exemplified was very similar to what Bill Clinton exemplified. And this was a major comparison point in 2016. And when he was pushed on the question of his life, his choices, redemption, forgiveness, his answers were what I expected. But what I didn't expect was for Christians to say, and that's great. You know, so when he says, I don't think I really asked for forgiveness, for instance, it's one thing to say, well, I don't really ask for forgiveness because I'm not myself what you would consider a Christian who values that. What he would say is, I didn't really ask for forgiveness. And then Scott Lamb, who co-wrote the book, The Faith of Donald Trump, would argue that he's actually exemplifying Christianity by saying that he doesn't ask for forgiveness.
These are
intellectual dishonesties.
There are people who, look, if you read your horoscope every day and you can figure out a way to make it mean whatever happened that day. There are people like that all across the political spectrum. On the Bill Clinton issue, though, it's an argument that's made often. Well, Republicans, evangelicals, were outraged by what Bill Clinton did, and now Donald Trump has done the same things. There's a couple of significant differences. Donald Trump, to the best of anybody's knowledge, hasn't done it while in office.
Sure.
And Democrats won that argument in the 90s. Now they're trying to lose the argument they won. I'm talking about not necessarily with evangelicals, but with the country writ large. They said this is a largely personal matter, and Bill Clinton left office wildly popular. And we said,
yes.
Okay, then I guess while it's personally repugnant, private behavior doesn't matter.
But if they did win that argument, number one, I would argue evangelicals never said they should have.
Right.
And
I don't think they should have, but they did. So these are the rules.
Right, which is something I talk about, the rules. Mm-hmm. But part of the problem for me is evangelicals continued to say all the way up until 2015 or 16 that somebody of a compromised character can't govern effectively until it was Trump. And similar things early on with the evangelical support in the primaries. It was very splintered among evangelicals. A lot of people think he just had them from the outset, but he didn't. It was splintered, and primarily it was splintered where people who had attended church most recently were most likely to have an issue with him. But by June, once it sort of became an inevitability that he was going to be the nominee, they coalesced around him, and obviously he got record-breaking numbers in the election.
Well, and the alternative is Hillary.
But that's I guess, what my issue is what that means, or what it says to me, and what I'm talking about a lot in the book, is that I understand partisanship as it relates to your team. You know, if you're a conservative, then in the primaries you fight for the conservative. Once the party has chosen the nominee, you're going to have to just let go of that if you lost the argument and go for the Republican. That's fine. But in terms of faith, I don't know that there is this binary choice. I don't know that there is this idea that you must pull the lever for a Republican in order to be expressing your faith in God. I think that's a dangerous way to look at religion.
But can't you be both? Look, I wouldn't want Donald Trump to marry my sister, except for maybe for the
or
settlement.
Or even be alone with her, right?
The settlement. No. I think he'd be fine. My oldest sister is in the Air Force. She can handle herself. I think all of them can probably handle themselves. But we're not voting for Pope. We're not voting for priest. We're voting for president. Mm-hmm. And out of two parties, they're the only options, realistic options, you are given two choices, one each. And it's everybody always complains, the lesser of two evils. I'm sick of choosing the lesser of two evils. But even if you love a candidate, if you were the biggest Mitt Romney supporter in the world, he's somebody else's evil.
Sure.
So you have to go into the voting booth and put aside all the crap. Mm-hmm. You can't just write in Jesus Christ every time and say, whatever, that's just going to be the choice.
Right.
So I want to talk about whether or not you
give. Well, I do want to make clear, I address in the book that it is not a question of whether or not you voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. And I know plenty of people that I'm friends with, that I have tons of agreements with, that did vote for Donald Trump. It is the way people, specifically in the church and in the evangelical community, are tying the support of Trump as an expression of faith that is a problem. It's the way people support him that is a problem. And it's similar to the complaints that we had about people who supported Obama, which is we saw this cultish mentality around it and that it's an issue. And that's nothing particularly new when it comes to famous people, politicians, or whoever. There's always going to be like this cultish following that will rise up. But when you're involving 26% of the electorate who are faith-based voters, and that faith is now being tied to one particular party, that's not only ripe for abuse, but it elevates people in the church into a position where their goals can be power-based. And I think that that's bad for the church.
I want to talk to you about the bifurcation between the congregation and the people who are getting rich off of it in a second. But I want to ask you about you, because you on social media are a lot like Trump.
Yeah.
You're perfectly willing to go after somebody like a rabid spider monkey, and you hit me, and it's just at the wrong time, and you happen to see it, you're willing to go nuclear over it. So the question, obviously, is how can I
moralize?
Is there not a level of hypocrisy there to a certain extent? Because you get personal, too, on Twitter.
Oh, absolutely.
And you've been attacked violently, or not violently, but viciously personally as well.
Sure.
So is that just a culmination of all the shit that's been piled on you coming to a head, or what?
In 2016, it certainly was.
Donald Trump has had, whatever you faced, a truckload of it every day.
Oh, no, and I get that, too. And in 2016, I would say a lot of what you're describing about the culmination, as you know, the period of time where you were saying you wanted someone else, you probably saw some of this as well. Mm-hmm. The attacks coming from certain sectors of the right who already supported him was vicious and unrelenting.
Right.
I was getting doxxed and people were writing lies about my divorce and, you know, all kinds of horrible things. And yeah, definitely, I was angry. And I look back at 2016 and I definitely say I was too angry. But as to the question of hypocrisy, I tried throughout the book, and I hope it came through, to make clear that there is no one that I don't consider to be immoral. I'm not calling a group immoral as though I am moral.
You're not sitting in judgment of them. You're saying I'm one of them.
Right. And in fact, the name is a play on the moral majority.
Right.
And the whole problem I have with the name The Moral Majority is that it's sort of implicitly saying that, right? It's saying, I'm moral, right, and you're not, and I'm going to bring my morality to you. So my issue with the idea that I can't speak on these things because of my own immorality.
I wasn't saying you
could. This is like my explanation for it, which is nobody could. Right. Like, we can't talk about morality if we don't have immoral people talking about it. Right. Like, we have to. As to my attitude on Twitter, my snarkalicious behaviors, I do reflect on these things, believe it or not, and I do want to be better. But, and this is going to sound like a cop-out, and I'm sorry that it is, when Bush got into office, one of the things that people were so happy about was the return of the dignity of the office, which means the office does mean something, or it did. And so I think there is an expectation that at least we used to aspire to as it comes to the office, and nowadays people are more happy to have somebody like me in there. And let me tell you, I shouldn't be in there. And I don't think that we should be lauding the behaviors that he's exhibiting either. I know it's fun, and I know why it's fun. Mm. And if people think I'm not tempted to just jump on the Trump train, they're wrong.
Can you differentiate between the behavior and the accomplishments? Not that he's, you know, running HUD and setting a housing policy or running HHS and deciding on drug prices or anything like that. But
I don't get mad about what he does at all anymore. I did in 2016. Mm-hmm. I don't at all anymore. There's nothing really that comes through his Twitter feed that makes me go,
but is there anything that comes out of the administration that you're like, hell
no,
yeah?
No, this is about the supporters. This is about...
No, I'm not talking... We'll get back to the
The policies, I like a lot of the policies. And I like a lot of the pushback that is on the... I don't like all the ways the pushback is exhibited. But I think that it's long overdue for media to be hearing something other than, please don't hurt us. Mm. That doesn't mean, though, that just because I appreciate the battle, that I like how that battle is being fought.
Back to the evangelicals and the evangelical leaders. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't evangelicals be conservative Republicans?
Because theoretically?
Maybe this is setting the ball on the tee for you. Mm-hmm. And I know I've heard you answer this question before, so in a way it is. When you have one party saying abortion up to and even, you know, a good 24 hours after birth, and everything else that goes against religious teachings that are slowly being changed by progressives from inside various congregations, how can, if you are an evangelical, and I'm a Catholic, so I'm just riddled with guilt about everything, but if you are an evangelical and abortion is important, it might not be the issue that moves your vote, but it certainly, you know, goes on this side of the scale rather than the other side of the scale, and everything else having to do with moral issues. Mm-hmm. What does the Democratic Party offer somebody like that? So then why shouldn't the Republican Party, if only by accident of not being the Democratic Party, not get that support?
Oh, well, I don't ever call for people to support a Democrat. There was, when Ted Cruz dropped out...
Well, I mean, you can replace Republican with Donald Trump. You
know, well, and, but what I'm saying is, if to me, and this is probably the core of the whole continuation of Never Trump, like, and not just my version of it, but other versions of it that you and I just were talking about, Max Boot and Jen Rubin and others.
All those nut jobs who flipped on a dime. Not only, like, I get if somebody doesn't like Donald Trump, that's fine. I happen to, but you're free to do whatever you want. But the people who were Republicans, conservatives, and now they not only don't like Donald Trump, because they don't like him so fervently, they've turned an Arianna Huffington. They're now the opposite of everything they used to,
yeah,
to be.
I refuse to pretend that things that I like are things I don't like. I like Brett Kavanaugh. I was happy he became a Supreme Court nominee and that he ended up on the bench.
Because he likes beer.
And because I think that the way that he was treated actually was helpful to a lot of people who needed to see how maligned you can become just by being pro-life.
Just for being a conservative.
Just for being a conservative at all. I thought that that was illustrative. And I obviously liked...
Neil Gorsuch.
Merrick Garland. I almost said that, by the way. That's why I paused.
May he rest in peace.
But for instance, tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
My objections to the tax cuts were not for the tax cut part. I liked the tax cut part. These objections I've had since Bush passed them, which is you can't stop cutting taxes and not cutting spending because I feel like you're ensuring a future budget crisis that didn't need to exist.
I agree with you there. I don't want to devolve into an economics argument, but federal revenues have never been higher.
Sure.
As every time demonstrates when you cut taxes, there's a dip. There's a dip in the immediate, but then the spur in growth brings back much more.
It always brings more revenue to the Treasury. That's not my concern.
Yeah, but they still set it on fire.
My concern is that they see more money, they spend
They're setting it. The printing presses on fire. They can't even wait to print it up anymore. They're setting it on fire as it goes through.
And that's my objection. But when
but
you
is
are
that
somebody...
Donald Trump? Or
no,
that,
when, that's and that's the problem, is that there is a little bit of bad faith when it comes to somebody like me and in my position, is online. If I make that objection, which I would have made under Bush and did make under Bush, it is tied to my Trump derangement syndrome, when it's not. This is just a genuine, normal objection. So that's why it's hard for me at this point, years into his presidency, how much time am I going to spend being aghast at his behavior? He's not going to change. He was never going to change. This is who he is. And that's why my focus has always been on what I think is a dangerous form of tribalist partisanship, and it's something that has grown since 2016.
Well, I agree that any sort of blind loyalty, everybody is bad. There's nobody I agree with 100%, not even me. So
I mostly disagree with
that. One of the things that annoyed me about the Obama administration is there were so many leftists in all walks of life, but most prominently in journalism and even in Hollywood, who acted as though he couldn't take a bath. Because he walks on water. He can't sink in it.
Right.
So when I do see that on the right, and it's a very small contingency, there's something. Because I will tweet criticisms of some of the president's moves. And people will say, you're right, he should have done this, that, or the other thing. People who otherwise would be all in and all on board. But when it comes to the evangelical community, differentiate between your average evangelical who's just going about their business and the leadership who are, you know, basking in the glory of having the president's ear and probably a cell phone number and able to get him on the phone and all the prestige and power that comes with getting booked on television because of that access.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you really have your problem.
It is. And it's one that kind of transcends politics because you're talking about, for instance, the congregations were polled on what was most important to them, and the evangelical leaders were polled on what was most important to them. And it was kind of inverse. You know, you had pastors who were saying the things you would normally think of, religious liberty, abortion, things of that nature. Those weren't the top issues for a lot of congregants.
Mm.
The top issues were economy, terrorism, things of that
nature.
Everybody
wants a job. Nobody wants to be killed.
Right. But and to be clear, I differentiate also between self-interest and selfishness. I don't think it's selfish to have self-interest. I mean, I am a capitalist. I think that self-interest is a motivator and a good thing. The question is, if you do things as a Christian that are supposed to be a higher calling than your self-interest and you choose your self-interest, then I would say that's selfishness. And that's what I see a lot of on the right, in the evangelical right and in the churches. And I think it's a failure of leadership.
Is that leadership failure unique to the Trump era, or has this been a long time coming?
This has been a long time coming. And I think that what it took me a moment to really process, especially as I started writing the book, was understanding what the goals of the modern... I mean, you know, the evangelical movement's been around for years. They were involved in Prohibition, you know. Mm-hmm. But the modern moral majority, Jimmy Carter era and forward, I think has a different agenda than I might have assumed. I think it is about power. And as a Christian, I often would make excuses for them. You know, it's not really about, you know, they just want to influence. They want to influence the culture in a moral way. And I had a lot of atheists, even, you know, conservative atheists going, dude, no, they don't. They want power, just like everybody else in D.C.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because I'm not an evangelical, but I do.
What?
I'm aware of,
look,
I said I'm a Catholic.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of the Pope. I've been public about that. I have my own problems, but the church is the church, and the direction they go, I can disagree with it, but I'm not going to be able to steer that. Evangelical movement in politics is different than the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that. But you see, I have a problem with a lot of evangelicals. I have a personal problem with anybody who gets rich off of God. Mm-hmm. I've always had that problem with it. If you've got a TV show and half of it is send me money, give us money, we'll help the poor, and you're going to your mansion in your private jet, driving your Lamborghini.
And a lot of them are straight up, like,
well,
snake
I know,
oil
I just,
salesmen that just threw the prayer requests out. I mean, like, literally.
Is there a way to root that out, or should it be rooted? I guess you can't root it out, and it's not like people are unaware of it. Like you said, you've got pastors going on television giving interviews about, yeah, well, I bought a Gulfstream 10. What do you want me to do? A 9 was too small. I'm not going to be able to fit enough people on a 9 and go all the way to China and that thing. So
there's a great Instagram account, actually, where a guy just has pictures of shoes.
The shoes. The ridiculous prices in shoes, and people still keep writing that check.
Mm-hmm.
So can the evangelical leadership, if that doesn't get you purged, if you're rocking $3,000 shoes while talking about how you got to take care of the poor,
mm-hmm.
if that doesn't bring you down.
But see, this is exactly what I'm trying to tackle, because it is that mentality of looking past certain things like, well, yeah, he's got these shoes. But that wasn't because of what came in at the church. It was because of the book he wrote.
Right.
So, like, they find ways to rationalize or whatever. And I'm saying, look, these kinds of questions wouldn't even be questions if, number one, and this isn't an overly popular thing, but I hope it does become popular, part of the problem is megachurches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because now it's not just megachurches. It's megachurches with satellite campuses.
We have one in Virginia that is gigantic, and
yeah, you've got
Starbucks
people
in there, and it's
mm-hmm.
it's
rock and roll and you know, all that good stuff, and it's like a big therapy session a lot of times.
It doesn't really matter how somebody practices their religion; it's the commercialization of it.
To me, the bigger problem is that it's becoming so large that you're joining a community where you don't know your pastor. You can't meet with him. You can't get a meeting with him because he's too busy. And you should talk to one of your satellite pastors who you also don't really know because he's never talking because you're always watching your pastor on a TV show.
Reminds me of, I almost took a job selling knives
mm-hmm.
once. And, you'd get a taste. And then the person who brought you in would get a taste.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person who brought them in would get a taste. And it's a pyramid.
Yes.
And that's how these mega churches are being
set
up.
Well, and I actually think there is a way for the mega church / satellite campuses to work. What has to happen, in my opinion, is that people need to look at Sunday church as an opportunity to gather with the community.
Mm-hmm.
But if they would, people are much closer to their faith when they get into smaller groups. You know, when they're in a Bible study, they're usually a little closer to their faith because they're sort of living life with their...
Well, in a small Bible study, you're interacting.
Right.
Whereas in row 10D in the upper deck,
right,
you're just sitting there.
Yeah, if you've got somebody, if you're going to, I'm going to try at this new church, and you're like sitting in the back of a room watching a guy on a TV screen who's 20 miles away at a church that has 10,000 people, I just have a hard time picturing that Jesus was like, that's what we want.
Right, it's like trying to pass. I really want to pass a plate to the coach at a college football game. And you got to fight your way through. It's not going to happen.
But
it's never going to get there.
A lot of these people get the same way that I talk about in the book as it relates to Donald Trump. They get the same way about their pastors, okay? Which is everything is constantly
on. Well, that's
on
how they can roll up in a Lamborghini and everybody just
right.
gives them a high five going, hey, great new shoes.
So my argument is, if you're going to support Trump on a transactional basis,
mm-hmm.
make it a transactional basis, which is you're going to get our support What we want in return is for you to not make it difficult for us to support you. I don't think that's what has happened. And if they were going to continue having that transactional relationship in spite of him not making it that easy for them to support him on certain things, then at the very least, don't make excuses for it when it happens. Like, be willing to say this is wrong and that is wrong without pointing to something Obama did 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
I'm not saying I agree with you, but in terms of your book and what you found and in your lived experience, why is it, in your opinion, that so many evangelicals were so willing to attach their wagon in an unquestioning way to Donald Trump, this flawed, obviously flawed person? But again, we've talked about that.
Right. Well, I think there's a
why do you think there's so many who were, you know, saw what was happening with Obama and the worship and that he can do no wrong,
and
even if it's 5% of evangelicals, mm-hmm. why are they? What are they lacking? What are they looking for? What are they hoping to get out of it? Why are they doing it?
I think that the way that politics over the last several decades.
Some people just want to win. They're sick of losing, so to hell with it.
Absolutely. But I think over the last 40 years, the idea of the culture war has obviously increased.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about the new rules in there. I think you're definitely a new rules subscriber in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. It sounds like a very reasonable thing. You've got a battlefield. And you've got an enemy. If you're going out there with, you know, a bowl of fruit, and they're coming at you with a gun.
Marcus of Queensbury rules, right. sir, and they got a baseball bat with knives sticking out of it.
You need to be able to meet them on the battlefield.
Right.
Right? You need to be able to be willing to do what they are, or you're going to lose.
Well, maybe they'll put the knives and bats down if they see you coming in and say, okay, let's go to Marcus at Queensbury Road. The only way to ever get them to pump the brakes on crazy is to hold them to that same standard.
Well, and we can debate whether or not that actually works.
I don't know if it'll work, but I know it hasn't really been tried.
I don't think it works, but I also know that while any number of pragmatic voters who are not claiming they're using or applying their faith to the issue might have a perfect, and I've said this in the book too, if you are perfectly pragmatic about this, I can't imagine why you wouldn't vote for Donald Trump. But if you are bringing the new rules to the situation, and you're talking about the situation with the culture in terms of a war, where you're willing to do essentially evil against evil, or mm-hmm. return evil with evil, then you have defied what the Bible says. So either say, I'm compartmentalizing, and I'm not going to include my religious beliefs as it relates to this, or I'm going to openly defy it because I'm more focused on the ends than the means. But just don't deny that's what you're doing. There's so much self-delusion about it.
But killing is evil. Yeah. Yet killing in self-defense
is not.
Is not.
Right. That's because both killing.
So engaging in.
But
in
murder
this sort
is
of,
evil. I would not automatically say killing is evil. There's been plenty of killings that have taken place in history that were done at the. Like you were saying, if somebody's trying to kill you. You're protecting your family. That's certainly, you're morally right to be to kill this person if you have to. What becomes immoral?
Baby Hitler murderer.
Right. Well, what becomes immoral is, for instance, I don't believe that a Nazi gets a moral pass for following orders. Mm-hmm. I think that if he was a Christian, then all the way up to the point of suffering and death, he should have been unwilling to comply. And that's something that not every faith or religion is called to, but it's certainly something evangelicals claim to be called to. So when they say we're applying a new form of morality because we're on the battlefield, I'm saying there's nothing in the Bible that says that that's what you should do, and in fact, it says you shouldn't.
Does the current leadership, I mean, look, I don't know how anybody becomes an evangelical leader. It just seems to me to be whether
it's a secret meeting.
Whether you got a good publicist who can get you booked on cable news,
mm-hmm.
and then suddenly you're a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But is the current state of and leadership occupants of evangelical leadership make you question your faith,
mm-hmm.
or question what does it make you question?
It makes me question what dangers there are with treating Christians and the church as a voter bloc. Because if you treat them as a voter bloc, I understand we'll do statistics and polling to figure out these are commonalities between these people. But the nature of politics is once they figure out those commonalities everybody markets to them.
Right, and they exploit them. That's just the nature of marketing, just like if you're trying to sell widgets. You want to find out who needs a widget, right. Who's more likely, where are they, let's go get them.
So what needs to happen is there needs to be a change in leadership, which is not something, obviously, these people aren't voted in
right.
and out.
It's not.
There just needs to be louder voices.
Cable news bookers.
I like Beth Moore. I like Russell Moore. And I don't think that they're treated as political because of their criticisms. But they're not involved in politics every day. They're mostly just talking about their church issues. Mm-hmm. And I want more of that. And I want those voices to get louder. And I want more people to write books and go on shows. And what I want is for less of Robert Jeffries, who doesn't bring religion to politics. He brings politics to religion. And I think that's the wrong calculus. You can bring your religious values to your vote, but if you are merging them too deeply, politics is a short-term thing. We're carried about the next election. Religion is eternal by nature. One's going to influence the other. They went there to influence politics. I think politics
in Ben Howe's
religion.
World, who was the last evangelical leader to get it right?
Billy Graham was great. I thought Billy Graham was great. I mean, he was fairly backed away from the partisan nature of politics. He was everybody's pastor when they were the president. He spoke with mercy. I mean, he took a lot of heat for going to the USSR in the, I think it was in the 80s. He went to the USSR and spoke to a huge congregation there. And a lot of politicos were concerned that he was giving Russia a propaganda tool. You know, to make it seem like they had more religious freedom than they did and use him to do that. And he was just like, you know, I don't care. If there's a KGB guy here who's trying to disrupt this, maybe he heard something he needed to hear. That's what I want. What I don't want are people like Robert Jeffries who says, for instance, if you come across a presidential candidate who represents the values that Jesus discussed on the Sermon on the Mount, you should run from him as far as you can. That seems fairly anti-biblical.
Now, you're a conservative guy. You've been a conservative activist for more than a decade, and now you find yourself a little bit in the exile from the conservative movement. But with the release of this book, you've also found yourself standing near wanting arms, willing arms from the left.
Yeah.
You've been on CNN and MSNBC. Come on, Ben. Come with us just this way. A, how do you turn that down? And B, what is it like? Because if you stray from the topic of the book and the topic that we've discussed in a discussion of policy and pretty much any aspect with a Don Lemon or a Jake Tapper, you're going to deviate immediately from them. Mm-hmm. What's it like going in there knowing that? And do they know that? And do they strictly avoid it because they can... No offense, but they can use you as a useful foil to go after the president.
I definitely don't take offense at the way you just described that, because that's something I had to wrestle with in 2016 as well. And I had a lot of friends who would come to me and say, you're going on TV and you're saying all these things about Trump. Do you understand that you're helping the left and they're only bringing you on because you're helping them?
Would you have been happier if Hillary won? You think the country would be better off if Hillary had won?
When?
2016.
No, I mean, do I think the country would have been better off when?
No.
Immediately?
No.
No, it wouldn't be better off right now. Do I think it would be better off in 10 years from now? Yeah. Because my concern is, look at the Overton window shifts on the Second Amendment issues. I think that these are huge concerns that are going to come to bite us soon. I think there's dangers related to a lot of the things that we've been trying to protect, like, for instance, through the Supreme Court. As opposed to the legislature where you're supposed to do it. But regardless, the Supreme Court has all the power, so whatever.
Until the Democrats restructure it.
My concern is that's what will happen. My concern is I don't want to protect something. Like, let's say the two Supreme Court nominees are the only ones he gets. Okay? Mm-hmm. And let's say that could protect us. Like, who's been on the court the longest right now?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think.
So let's say 35 years. Okay? So 35 years. 35 years of these two guys. But other people are going to start dropping off. Other people are going to start picking up. If we have not put ourselves in a position as conservatives...
Clarence Thomas, now that I think about it.
Oh, is it?
I believe so. He's appointed by Bush. He's the only one.
Oh, yeah. If we haven't put ourselves in a position to have the stronger argument that is attracting people as opposed to speaking to ourselves, then it's great that we protected things in the short term, but it was at the cost of the long term. And as somebody who has four kids, I am more concerned about the long term than I am the short term.
Well, it's not a fiscal cliff with $100 trillion in unfunded liability. It's going to collapse. This is a can that can be kicked down the road a little bit and pulled back, an edge that can be pulled back from.
Sure. Except I see a trajectory for a long time before Trump.
No. There's no doubt that we're, as a country, starting long before Trump, we were headed towards this. You can argue that Trump accelerated it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't mean to distract you from the argument of what it's like to sort of be the toast of Manhattan and Morning Joe.
Well, I think it's interesting and educational, and at times it's actually, if I dare say, inspiring, because while there's plenty of what you're talking about.
Do you have Joe's song on your phone?
No, we're going on a date later tonight. Okay, no. Well, the I'll tell you the parts that are inspiring are the conversations I've had after work done with the interview, and usually not with the main host, but with some of the other people either that work on the set or John at CNN New Day, for instance. You know, really meaningfully good faith conversation with an awareness of inherent disagreements and no need to convince each other of the things that we don't agree on. We were just fine agreeing on the thing we agree on. But obviously there are people who are going to be like, Ben, tell us why evangelicals are representative of how Trump's racism is going to destroy everything in the world. I have to be willing to go anywhere to talk about what I believe. My editor said something to me, you know him as well. Yeah. I love the way he put it to me, which was, you don't have a movement. There's not like a movement behind you. But what you're doing is you're planting a flag and saying, this is what I think. And whoever wants to come talk to me about it or join me at this flag can. If that's CNN, then that's CNN. If it's MSNBC, it's MSNBC. I'm going on Dennis Prager on Monday. And he literally said, I disagree with your premise when he asked me to come on the show. Mm-hmm. I have to be willing to go on all of these shows and not concern myself with whether or not they're going to try to use me.
Dennis is going to give you a grilling.
I know.
Very smart man.
And I think that in the same sense that...
They'll do it in a polite way.
But in the same sense that the people who are of the left are going to try to use me as an illustration for their point, I think Dennis Prager will try to use me as an illustration for his. And so my job is not to try to figure out which show I can go on where I won't be used, because this is media. They're all using me for whatever their purpose is. I just have to make sure that I don't stray from what I actually think.
Lastly, Ben, as somebody takes this book before they set it on fire, obviously, and shove it down the toilet, like it's a...
By the way, but buy it and then set it on fire.
I love it. Somebody asked me, like, when my book came out last year, like, well, don't you want people to read the books? Care if anybody reads it. I want to buy it. They can use it to balance a coffee table.
Yeah, somebody said boycott Ben the other day. I was like, what you really need to do is gather as many people as you can and get some book burnings going. Here's the link to Amazon.
As they close the last page on the immoral majority, if there is somebody out there, Trump voter, not necessarily evangelical, likes what the president is doing as president, but cringes a little when they see the tweets, what do you want them to take away when they shut the flap for the last time?
I want them to take... Is this person a Christian, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay. What I want them to take away is that there are larger things in our lives, even as consequential as the world is in our everyday life. The eternal is always more important and should be the number one priority, not avoiding our own, even at times, persecution and suffering. We can't put ourselves in a position, or I don't believe we should put ourselves in a position, where we are putting our fates in the hands of the world because we believe that's the only way to serve God, when I think God has it. And that what I hope, not just the Christian you're describing, but a progressive or a liberal who picks up the book, finishes it and thinks, there's more to these people that I hate than meets the eye. I don't want to live in a world where there's a litmus test for being witnessed to, listen, let go of your progressive ways, and then I'll talk to you about God. Like, and I feel like that's where it's almost at certain, with certain segments of the population. I want that to stop.
Kumbaya, my lord. Kumbaya.
Now I'm going to go yell at somebody on Twitter and call them.
You're going to go curse on a cabbie. The book Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. We didn't agree on everything. We don't agree on everything. Mm. I thought it was pretty simple.
It was good.
I mean, I poisoned you slowly with your Coca-Cola, but it'll be weeks before.
Right. And you know, I'm going to be called, you know, why'd you bring that dirty Never Trumper on and so on.
Yeah.
I don't like being called a Never Trumper.
I've already gotten that from friends. Yeah. Are you a Never Trumper?
I do not consider myself somebody.
Could you see yourself voting for Donald Trump if it's...
It depends on who Donald
Trump
becomes.
Actually, wait a second. Let me ask you one more thing, because it's interesting. The left is trying to co-opt religion in a great many ways. You got Pete Buttigieg out there.
I called him out for that.
I'm not a biblical scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but I think my understanding of the Bible is a little bit good enough to look at some of the things Pete Buttigieg is talking about and think, that's not exactly right. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the left trying to co-opt religion, and it's all moral this, and we got to do this because it's the moral thing to do after 40 years of telling us you can't legislate morality. Now they're telling us you must legislate because of morality. And is there anybody on the left who you see as doing it either right or sincerely rather than as a cynical ploy?
Well, there's nobody that I see in politics doing anything that is
not varying degrees. Look, Mitt Romney, you could disagree with him, but he's a pretty religious guy. He's a Mormon, but nobody thought that he's saying, you know, be good and moral, and then he's got five hookers.
Well, let's
out
just say this. I would say that when Pete Buttigieg says some of what he has said about these supposed Christians voting against the minimum wage,
right,
is I think what he was talking about at one point. I find that to be dangerous rhetoric that is identical to what I'm complaining about here. And I do not have any interest in replacing a conservative rightward evangelical movement with a progressive leftward evangelical movement. I'm interested in breaking partisanship from the process. I'm not talking about politics in general. I don't think it's possible to be a religious person and not have it influence how you see things in politics. Mm-hmm. But I don't want it to be assigned to a particular ideology or partisan tribal team, because I think that's where you run into the issue with these leaders who will help cultivate the crew to come support one group all the time as you pull the lever for us, and that's pulling the lever for God. And Buttigieg was doing that.
Yes.
He was basically saying, vote for this or you're not a Christian, and I object to that.
We need to raise the minimum wage or else you're not a Christian. Here, give me this. You're going to sign these books for us, and you can enter. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com.
This is for the book burning?
This is for the book burning. You can start your own grill. They wadded these up really small. There's a lot of them, so it's going to come pouring out. These are for the Liz Wheeler books.
Okay.
Pick two. Don't read the email, but read the name. And
what about the Social Security number?
Well, we've already opened up credit cards, so you can do whatever you want with that.
All right. First up, we got Steve and Cammie Mitchells.
There you go. Mitchells, the Mitchell family. Congratulations.
I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I mean, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, K-M-I. Or K-A-M-I. I have dyslexia and really bad eyes, so. Mm-hmm.
I can't read, so.
Well, I know that.
I've
read your
book. Oh, and then we have Julie Hunt Junot.
Julie Hunt Junot. Sacre bleu.
You know what I'm talking about.
Congratulations. Yes, you know who you're talking about. Hey, you talking to me? Ben, best of luck with the book. We don't agree on everything, but I like you.
Appreciate
nonetheless.
It.
Thank Quit you. Smoking.
Oh, what are you talking
Knock
about?
Knock that shit off. All right, that is it for this week. It's Friday. Go out, have a beer, have some fun, relax a little bit, and be back here on Monday. See you then.